KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is the weekend before Christmas, and thankfully, all through the theaters, there's no more holiday movies opening. It is only superheroes, fast cars, wrestling, and a musical. And here to review them, we have Sean Edwards, award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Hello, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. And William Bibbiani is film critic and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Bibbs, hello.
Still no awards,
well,
but I'm
what's
here
wrong
and I'm ready
with
to
you?
Review movies. I don't know.
We're going to give you an award.
Thank you.
At the end of this, you're going to get an award. Okay.
Neat.
Let's get excited. Let's start with DC's Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. It's directed by James Wan. Jason Momoa returns as the titular seafaring superhero.
I'm the king of Atlantis. Half a billion people from every known species in the sea call this place home. But that doesn't mean they all like me. I'm gonna kill Aquaman and destroy everything he holds dear.
Okay, Bibbs, this is supposed to be the final DC film before James Gunn reboots it all, and they're following up on their most popular film. What do you think? Did Aquaman go out with a bang?
You know, it's been 10 years. There have been about 15, depending on how you count, maybe 16 films in the DC Extended Universe. There have been some great films. There have been some bad films. And I think it was a really interesting choice for Warner Brothers to end the franchise on a film so bad that we won't even miss it. It's like, oh, thank God we're done. We don't have to do this again. Because Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom is pretty staggeringly inept in a lot of ways. Story-wise, it's weirdly repetitive of the original movie. They just switched some characters around. So now, instead of bickering with Amber Heard, Jason Momoa is bickering with Patrick Wilson to the exact same result. Meanwhile, Amber Heard has been cut out of the movie so haphazardly that instead of being a powerful superhero with a powerful personality, now she spends the movie having babies, doing laundry, and sitting quietly by Jason Momoa's side like a dutiful housewife. It's weird. It's sexist. It makes Aquaman look bad. And on top of it all, it's just visual chaos from start to finish. It's kind of hard to make out a lot of the time. The plot makes no sense. The dialogue is laughable. I lost count of how many times I saw a baby pee in Jason Momoa's face. It's a pretty pretty bad movie. It's the kind of bad superhero movie that superhero movies have spent like the last couple of decades trying to prove that they're not. It's a real downer.
Wow, I just have that image of the baby in my head now. I can't shake it. Sean?
Bibbs is 100% correct. I would like to offer a counterpoint, but I can't. This movie's bad. Superhero fatigue is real, but poor and unimaginative storytelling is the real problem. I actually thought I was watching the first Aquaman while I was watching this Aquaman. They are so similar, and not for a good reason. It's just, it's all a travesty. And yes, there is a visual assault going on. James Wan, the director, overpopulates every frame of this film to the point that it's all distracting. And poor Jason Momoa, I mean, he tries. I mean, he really tries. But he might as well have been in every scene waving a white flag. I mean, there's nothing he could do but surrender. This thing is a mess.
It's almost like, so I don't feel for him.
Well, I don't, but this is a casualty that's only adding to the demise of the genre because no one's figured out how to do anything fresh, different. You know, it's all a mess at this point in time. And wow, what a way to go out. So sad.
Okay. Well, if you dare, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom in theaters beginning today. Next up, we have a drama from A24. The Iron Claw follows the Von Erich brothers as they rise to wrestling stardom, based on a true story, written and directed by Sean Durkin and starring Zac Efron and the bear himself, Jeremy Allen White.
We're here to restore justice to the Wrestling Federation that our father built with his own two hands. The hands that were passed down to us. The hands that will deliver the Iron Claw to you.
Hey, Sean, this movie wrestles with heavy trauma, quote unquote.
Wrestles.
Ha ha. And follows the real story of the Von Erich family in the 1980s. We got some Rush there, thankfully. What did you think?
Well, since we're doing the pun thing, this movie had me in a total headlock, but for a good reason. Director Sean Durkin, he takes the name of the film from a move that was created by Fritz Von Erich, who's the father of this clan of sons. I like this movie a lot because it goes back to the 1950s in the early days. It's pre what we know wrestling to be today. It's nothing like what we see with WWE in its current state. It goes back to the early days of wrestling. I love watching a movie that I simply knew nothing about.
Ooh.
No, I did know about the Iron Claw move because we used to do it when we were kids, but I didn't know where it came from. I didn't know how it was created.
What is it?
You position your hand like a claw, like a hawk, and you smash it down on your opponent's face. Whether or not you actually go through with it or not is debatable because there is some controversy to whether or not wrestling is actually a sport, whether or not the participants are actually athletes. But the film does nicely address this, but it deals more with this supposed family curse. And there's a lot of serious stuff, and there's a lot of things that happen to this family that are, I mentioned loosely, sort of addressed in the film. It does so enough that it really garners your attention because it's done in a very realistic, somber, and totally engrossing way. But there's so much going on with this family that I almost wish this film were a series, because you could do a separate movie on each one of the sons. There's a lot going on in this movie, and it's raw, and it's rich, and it's sad, and it's grim, but I just wish they had more time to expand on everything that happened with each one of these sons who ultimately have a tragic end.
Oh, wow. Okay. And Zac Efron is good. He's broken out of his High School Musical chains, so to speak.
100%. All of the cast. I mean, Jeremy Allen White is great as well. And that's the thing that works really well with this film, is because there's a believability with each of the actors. My only gripe with the film is I just wish they had more time to expand on the story, because the mother sort of gets lost, and there are bits and pieces of the film where the dad and his ambitions get lost, because you're covering all of the sons and you're covering this whole entire industry. And there's just not enough time to really, really center everything and expand on everything the way you would want it to. And that's why I say it would work a lot better if it were a series.
The Iron Claw in theaters beginning today. All right, time to shift gears and talk about Ferrari, directed by Michael Mann. The film follows Enzo Ferrari, who is played by Adam Driver.
Am I a sportsman? Or a competitor? If you get into one of my cars, you get in the win.
Bibbs, this film follows Enzo and his wife, Laura Ferrari, at a rocky moment in their marriage in 1957. Tell us more about the story that drives them to this point.
Ferrari stars Adam Driver as Enzo Ferrari, stars Penelope Cruz as his wife, and stars Shailene Woodley as his longtime mistress. And this is about a very short period in which the future of the Ferrari company was really uncertain. They had just lost world records to other companies. They just lost their biggest racer. There's a decent chance that they're not going to be able to keep the company going at all. It's all on the line. Meanwhile, Enzo Ferrari's marriage is falling apart. Michael Mann is a great filmmaker, and one of the things that he excels at, maybe more than any other filmmaker, is telling stories about people who are good at their jobs. Often that means cops and robbers, but he's told great stories about, you know, working at 60 Minutes, about the boxing industry. And here he's telling a story about the automotive industry. And whenever it is doing that, it is really, really great. And frankly, even the emotional story between Enzo Ferrari and the two women in his life is really quite exceptional. My issue with this movie, and it's a little thing, but it's consistently distracting, is that Adam Driver, 40-year-old man, is playing a 60-year-old in pretty unconvincing makeup. It looks like he was just made up to look like a 60-year-old in a Saturday Night Live sketch.
Well, I noticed he has the same hair as Tom Cruise does in Collateral.
Oh, God. I wish it was coiffed so nice. He has this weird exact hairline. Like
this
but
weird white hair, yeah.
Right, and it's fine. He'll make him look older, but it would make sense to make him look older if like a significant amount of the film also had Adam Driver younger. He only appears as like his own age in like flashbacks for like 2 minutes of the screen time tops. So for the majority of the movie, you've got Adam Driver not convincingly looking 60 next to actual actors who are that age, and it's really distracting. It's still good. If you can get past that, it's a finely crafted drama in a lot of ways, but it's just an example of one piece in the puzzle is misplaced and the whole thing doesn't look quite right.
You know, another thing that is distracting to me is when they're Italian, they're in Italy, and they're speaking English with Italian accents. I don't know, this bugs me. Sean, what did you think of this?
No, I do agree with that. And I can get past Adam Driver not looking 60 because Michael Mann does such a terrific job directing this film because he's given Ferrari sort of the Ali treatment. And much like that 2001 film about the famed boxer, Mann has smartly chosen to focus on a specific point in Enzo Ferrari's life, which I thought really makes this film excel. Now, I would say that the race scenes are brilliant. They are fabulously shot, but this isn't necessarily a film about racing. I mean, this is much more a film about what's going inside the head of a man who's actually going through some challenges. I mean, he's dealing with issues personally. He's dealing with issues professionally. And like Bibbs mentioned, he's toggling between his wife. He's toggling between his mistress. He's toggling between a failed business. And this film does a good job of really laying that all out. So you get an understanding that this particular individual is at a crossroads in life and what direction is he going to go in and, you know, what will the outcome be? I will say Penelope Cruz provides all of the energy and the adrenaline. She's fabulous. Poor Shailene Woodley is treated like a real life mistress because she seldom pops up. And when she does, she's not given very much to do. Mm. And my one quip about, you know, Adam Driver is I felt he was a little too stoic, almost to the point of almost really never registering a pulse. And I just wish he just delivered a little more energy or a little more personality. But the film maintains its watchability, even if it is a bit too subtle and a bit too nuanced.
Ferrari in theaters December 24th, Christmas Eve. Finally, the latest from Warner Brothers, produced by Oprah Winfrey and Steven Spielberg. It's directed by Blitz Bazawule, and it's a musical adaptation of The Color Purple, starring Fantasia Barrino.
It's time for you to see the world.
There's gonna be some changes made.
Put it on. This ain't me.
Hush.
We need to look like we belong.
Let's see the smile and color.
Sweet and loving God.
All right, Sean, this film is the latest in a long string of adaptations of The Color Purple. And what did you think?
Yeah, well, I will say this. This version of The Color Purple has more to do with Janet Jackson and Steven Spielberg, because this retelling of The Color Purple, which is the adaptation of the Tony Award-winning Broadway production, which is based off the 1982 Pulitzer Prize novel, is about control and reclaiming the narrative. Now, the first thing you will notice that this version is a lot glossier, more stylistic, cheerful, and at times more playful because the vibe is dreamy and the tone is very hopeful. And the subject matter, it hasn't changed. However, the tone is a real remarkable departure from the book and the 1985 film. And this version doesn't resonate as deeply as the 1985 film, but in many ways, it's more entertaining and uplifting. Now, the time period remains the same, but the rural Georgia location has been robustly photographed. I mean, first-time feature film director, I can't believe this was a first-time feature film director, Blitz Bazawule, has really created a show-stopping musical that has these really energetic numbers, and the production values are glossy, particularly the cinematography, which showcases the complexity of Black skin, perhaps better than any film ever. Now, if there is a negative to the film, is that the Mr. character isn't as menacing as the 1985 film, and actually, all of the men in this film are much nicer, something that the novel and Steven Spielberg's version was really heavily criticized for back in the day. And also, if there's another gripe, the relationship between Celie and Shug Avery has been really severely sanitized. But that's sort of nitpicking, because this cast is exuberant, and like this, The Color Purple sort of works as this gleeful tribute. It's like a cinematic church service and a celebration of culture and a love letter to literature. And it's all about reclaiming, and the entire production just screams, how dare you nominate the original film for 11 Oscars and not award it anything? And this is what we've done to sort of like set that wrong and make it right.
All right, Bibbs, the main character, Celie, she, in the book, as Sean alluded to, goes through some pretty horrific things. And yet the story kind of, I guess, Sean glosses over them a little bit. But Bibbs, what did you think?
I think the first like half of the movie is, you know, relatively harrowing for this kind of production. But, you know, the purpose of the narrative isn't to, you know, make it curl up in a ball at the end and wonder if there's any good left in the world. There's a hopeful quality to it. And I will say this, they've directed some incredible performances out of this movie. And I think that, if nothing else, the music is really, really good. It's wonderfully filmed, but like the performances, like across the board, are really fantastic here. And I think that gets everything through. Fantasia Barrino, it knows how to act and sing at the same time, something that not every actor in a musical movie seems to do nowadays. Danielle Brooks steals every single scene they're in. Colman Domingo is just incredibly loathsome. It does feel as though all of the queer elements of the movie have been shoved aside as much as possible, while still technically, like, if you want to see it, it's there. That feels a little... it feels like the film has a lack of confidence in that regard. But overall, I think this is actually a very strong production. And again, if only for the performances, I think it should be seen.
All right. The Color Purple in theaters on Christmas Day, December 25th. And that'll do it for us today. That is the last film review segment of the year. And Bibbs, we have your award. you get the Iron Claw Award.
Yes.
Oh, great. I love it. It's like in the shape of a hand going, "Rar." Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I love you for
that. So now you have to introduce me as the award-winning film critic.
Yes. You clawed off the man. You really did. You clawed off the man.
It clawed me first.
It clawed you first. William Bibbiani is an award-winning film critic and co-host of the Critically Acclaimed Network. And Sean Edwards is an award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you both, and happy holidays, and see you in the new year.
Thank you so
happy
much.
Holidays.
Happy holidays.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.